Same date, the 8th of June. This is Professor Meltzer. This is tape 3, side 1, and we've all agreed that Dr. Meltzer should continue telling us about his association, his opinions, etc., on President Reagan.
Well, I think we stopped. I was saying how he had a clear objective. For example, you would never find President Reagan willing to say, well, let's try a little more inflation because it'll make the economy good. I mean, his basic message to you would be, we came here to bring the inflation rate down. It was 10-12% when he came into office. It was about 3-4% when he left office. He would say, if you talk to him about it, and I've heard him express himself on this, you know, it's still too high, would be what he would say. We haven't succeeded in getting to our objective. If someone said to him, well, let's do, as happened many times, let's do this, and it would work against his long-term aim, he would say, well, that isn't what we came here to do. So that he really stuck to his objectives, and he had a few things which were terribly important to him that he wanted to do, and those were, and you could not get him to deviate from those. What mostly would happen was when people would make a strong and sometimes impassioned plea for something that was different, he just didn't say anything. But, I mean, it had no, in my experience with him, and even more in talking to people who had much more experience, like George Shultz, who had much more experience with him, it had no effect on him. I mean, he just was convinced the next day when you met him, he was as convinced of what he wanted to do as he was on the previous day. So you didn't change his mind by making pleas. Now, he listened to facts, he was flexible in the sense that he knew that you couldn't get everything you wanted, but as far as his objectives were concerned, they were always they always remained consistent with his basic philosophy. That's rare among presidents. I mean, they didn't jump. I mean, if you think about presidents you know that sometimes they're on this side of the issue, sometimes they're on that side of the issue. That was not true of President Reagan. Now, he had shortcomings too. He was not interested in detail. He could have been more interested in the detail of how things were being done, because sometimes those really didn't move in the direction that he wanted to go. But he was a remarkably good president, and he liked the job. I mean, that was one of the things that was great about him. He didn't regard the job, even though he was in his 80s, he didn't regard the job as a burden. He regarded it as something he enjoyed doing. He got up every day, I think, to meet the challenge of the day.
Did you meet Mrs. Reagan at all?
Only through casual kinds of social events, things like that.
Since you feel that he had these long-term goals and was consistent in sticking to them, do you think there was a downside to that? I mean, you mentioned that you felt that maybe things would be better if he could look into detail, we'd be more interested in details, but was there a downside, do you think, to this kind of a person, or...?
Well, I think the presidents any good or an important president, and I think President Reagan will go down in history as a very successful president when the smoke clears. I mean, he ended the Cold War. I mean, it was his strategy. In my view, he ended the Cold War and he strengthened the economy. Now, he didn't accomplish everything that he wanted to do, but he basically strengthened the economy and by bringing down the inflation rate and by getting the growth rate back up, and by giving people confidence that the United States could make the transformation from what was essentially a manufacturing economy based upon steel and automobiles into what is now called the information age. And a lot of that transformation occurred during his period. But he also did it with a strong belief that the United States had to be the leader in the world toward open markets, freer trade, things of that kind. That's, of course, extremely important for the future. If we lose that, we risk going back into the kinds of conflicts that we had in the 1930s, trade conflicts, military conflicts. So on the great issues of his day, he was, I think, on the right side and moved ahead. But, of course, his greatest accomplishment was ending the Cold War, that is, bringing the Russians into agreement. And there, he showed, and that was not the area I had anything to do with, but there he showed great flexibility, that is, the willingness and ability to negotiate. There were many people in his administration who didn't want him to do that, and people high up who didn't want him to negotiate with the Russians, who believed that he wasn't the best negotiator, and second, who didn't believe that negotiations would get anywhere, that you couldn't trust the Russians to negotiate. Reagan was a man who believed in himself, very strongly in himself, so he had no concern about meeting Gorbachev or other foreign leaders. That he had met lots of people in his life, and he had been able to deal with them on a personal as well as a professional basis, and he had great self-confidence, and that helped him a lot.
Do you think his age had something to do with it?
Of course, I didn't know. I never knew him at a younger age, and I expect that probably age did give him a sense of himself. That people said that Eisenhower had that same kind of sense of himself, mm-hmm. that he had done many things in his life, and he had been successful at many of them, and he thought, this is a task which many people have done before me, and I can do it too, and do it well. So I don't think the president never showed evidence of self-doubt, of great self-doubt, or concern, or worry about what people would say about him, and so on.
There was talk about the fact that he was a lightweight intellectually. Do you think that was true? Or?
Well, I think that there's a misperception about that. He was not a man who cared much about detail. But in terms of his basic views, they were well thought out, consistent. I mean, I would gladly take on a president who, quite apart from the politics of the thing, who understands what he wants to do and has clear goals and works toward them on a regular basis, knowing all the difficulties of doing that in the world and in the U.S. government, than one who perhaps is more philosophical and introspects about issues and can't make a decision.
Okay.
Great leaders often see things with clarity that perhaps to a person who knows a great deal more about them don't look that clear. But they have the ability to make a decision and say, that's what we're going to do, now we've decided to do it, let's get it done.
He also knew how to get the right people around him, didn't he?
Yes, I think he worked with many people. He worked well with people. He was not a warm person. He was, it is said by people who knew him better than I, that he never said thank you. That may have been a failing. I mean, he accepted what you did, and he was not a warm person. You didn't get close to him. He probably, aside from his wife, didn't have very many really close friends, at least as far as one could see. You know, he spent his weekends alone with his wife, for the most part.
Interesting. One other thing that I'd like you to comment on is his appointments on the Supreme Court. There's been talk about the beginning of a more conservative court, and actually there were openings. And I was just curious what your opinions were of that.
About his court appointees?
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of them are really quite outstanding. I mean, the man that they call Nino Scalia, Antonin Scalia, is clearly a strong intellectual person. Conservatism, let me put it in this context, is, like liberalism, has many facets. There are conservatives who want to return to some, in their mind, prior golden period, and there are what are called libertarians, people who believe in freedom, that is, in allowing that the government should be as little intrusive as possible in the lives of ordinary individuals, both economically and socially. Now, much of the political conflict in this country is between two groups who get the most attention. People who are often in favor of economic freedom, but social restrictions. That is, they want to impose rules on other people, which they believe to be good. And on the other side are people who are social liberals, that is, they believe in letting people do what they want, but they're in favor of restricting commerce and business and trade and that sort of thing. Libertarians are people who are more in the middle. They believe in freedom both in commerce and business and economic activity, and also in social realm, and they tend to get squeezed out of the political debate. Now, many of the people, several of the people that President Reagan put on the Supreme Court are more libertarian than conservative. That is, they don't want to impose social rules. So that, for example, on abortion, which is an issue that receives much attention, it surprised the press, who tend to see these people as liberals and conservatives, that Reagan appointees, some of them, would vote in favor of free choice. They might believe that that's a very bad choice in society, but they also believe it's not the government's business to decide on those choices, it's the individual's business to decide on those choices. Hence, they would be inclined to say, yes, you know, we don't think that it's a good idea, we would not want our wives or daughters to have abortions, but we don't believe that it's the government's business to make that decision for people, it's the individual's decision to make those decisions. Well, I think many of the people who we put on the court, or several of them, are of that kind. That is, people who are libertarian rather than conservative. And I think that distinction probably gets lost in much of the discussion. And that, I mean, his administration was full of people with conflicting ideas, but as every administration is, right? And so much of the fight within about policy doesn't take place between the president and Congress. It takes place within the administration. People within every administration, between people who want to do one thing and people who want to do another. People who are liberals in, let's say, the current administration, that is, who want economic restriction and people who want the government to take a big role in the economy, people who want the government to take a lesser role in the economy. Those fights go on both between the president and Congress and within every administration.
Well, I think, any other comments you'd like to make about President Reagan?
No, I'm of course, a partisan of President Reagan. I worked for him because I believed in many of the things that he was doing. And I believe the country is better for his having been president. And he certainly was a master at keeping the public happy with him. I mean, I'm sure that if he had run for a third term, that had been permissible. He would have been reelected. He was very, very popular when he left office. Because I think he appealed to the individualism, the love of freedom, the sense of purpose that still infuses a great part of American society.
I'd like to ask you one more question about this. How come David Stockman stayed for such a short period of time?
Well,
I thought he was sort of a wonder child from Harvard.
He was disaffected with the Reagan, with what had happened under the Reagan policies. He wanted the president to cut spending, mainly to cut spending in order to balance the budget. The president certainly was in favor of a balanced budget, but it was not the highest priority in his mind. The highest priority in his mind was, as far as the budget was concerned, first and foremost, as he showed, was maintaining a strong military presence, and because he believed, and I think ultimately proved to be right, that he would frighten the Russians into a negotiation out of which we would come out better. Now, the Nixon-Kissinger doctrine, in my view of foreign policy, was that gave the Russians parity in nuclear arms and treated détente, because Henry Kissinger believed and said on many occasions that democracies were not well equipped to stay the course and hold down the spread of communism. So he was, Ronald Reagan never believed that. In his heart of hearts, he believed that free people would in the end triumph. And that may be true as a general principle or not true as a general principle, but in his mind, there was absolutely no question about it, and he was going to make it happen. And if you read George Shultz's biography or of his experience there, you come away with a strong sense that he never wavered in that belief, and he was convinced. And he saw as part of that you had to increase military spending here, because what was 6% of our, at the most, 6% of our spending, that is, of our national spending, was 25 or 30 or 40% of the Russians. Yeah. And that each time we went up 1%, they had to take enormous increases of a failing economy. So he believed that by spending that money, he was going to build up the military, he was going to force them into negotiations. And I believe he succeeded. He succeeded. I mean, the people mocked his belief in SDI, but in the Strategic Defense Initiative. But from his earliest days, in 1976, before he was elected president, he was running against President Ford. Martin Anderson, who worked with him in all of his campaigns, tells the story about President Reagan going to see the SAC base, the Strategic Air Command base outside of Omaha, where we had control of our missiles. And we based our defense on the idea of our ability to blow them up if they blew us up. That is, it was called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction.
Is that a balance of power?
That was the balance of terror. That we would have the capacity to blow them up if they tried to blow us up. And when President Reagan went to the Strategic Air Command base, he asked the general, according to Anderson, what we would do. And the general said, well, if their missiles are coming in or something like that, we send our missiles over there and basically blow them up. And he went out and said at the time, no president will do that. He said, we have to find a better way. So when Edmund Teller came to him with the idea that we could have a defense against missiles, he believed that he had the way to get around, that we could defend against those missiles. Even if some of them got through, we would save a large part of that was important, and it was something he wanted to spend money for. And the Russians, according to Schultz's book, were absolutely opposed to letting them do it. And so Schultz saw that as the huge lever by which he would bring the Russians into negotiation. And they worked on that, and they had a four-part policy, which were freedom for the Russian people. I mean, more freedom for the Russian people. They tried to convince the Russians that they needed to open up their society. But they also had this military threat, which the Russians were trying to negotiate down. And he hung on. He believed, for example, against the advice of many, many people, and scared the wits out of some of his allies, by agreeing, for example, coming very close in Iceland to agreeing on what he had originally proposed, which people laughed at, called the zero-zero option, that we would reduce all of our missiles and get rid of all of our atomic weapons, all of our ground, we would just eliminate them. Now, many of his advisors thought our whole strategy is based on the idea that nuclear weapons, that if we don't have nuclear weapons, we have to have big ground forces. The Russians have a huge population, and they're a captive state. That is, they can get as many people into the army and keep them there as they want. But we have to pay people to be in the army. We have to, it's just very difficult to do that in democratic society. Therefore, our initial, from the 1950s on, initial position had been, we're going to have weapons which will counterbalance these big ground forces, tanks, and so on. We have to have some of that, but that we will not build and maintain a field army for years and years and years capable of meeting them and defeating them on the central plains of Europe. Therefore, we're going to use strategic and tactical nuclear weapons. Right? So when they saw him willing to bargain that away, people thought this man is out of his mind. Yet he believed, you see, that nuclear weapons were a terrible thing, that you had to get rid of them, that you didn't want put them in the position where one side would use a first strike or try to take advantage of it. That was his belief. And in Iceland, he almost got there. It hung up on the fact that at the last minute, President Gorbachev wanted him to get rid of the defensive weapons, the Stalins. And on that, the president simply refused. I mean, now, it was another example of where he had made up his mind. There was no set of words once he had made up his mind that would convince him. I mean, you had to be terribly persuasive, more persuasive than I ever saw anybody with him, to convince him that once he had made up his mind, that that was not the right thing to do. He was convinced that the nuclear war was a bad thing, it was a terrible thing, that he wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons insofar as he could. And of course he managed to do remarkably well. For the first time in his administration, we negotiated treaties in which we reduced the amount of weapons on both sides.
Okay, thank you. Okay, today is June 22, 1994. Gabrielle Denman interviewing Alan Meltzer. This is the continuation of tape 3. We are again at his office at Carnegie Mellon University. Mary Harrison is the recorder. And just to see if your voice comes through, Dr. Meltzer, tell us, when you were in Washington on the assignment that we talked about last week, where did you live?
I lived in an apartment at 29th and K Streets.
Okay, now let's just... Okay. Did your family come with you? Or
my wife.
Your wife came with you. Did you keep your house here?
Yes, yeah. I kept my house here.
I see, okay. I think we'll continue in that vein because it's interesting. I also see photographs of you with Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, Mrs. Thatcher was arriving in that picture on the White House lawn. I didn't go out to see her, but the press photographers were there, and she's in the picture. She's interviewing the guard with President Reagan. She arrived by helicopter onto the White House lawn, and then she came out and reviewed the troops.
So did you meet her?
I had met her, but not on that occasion.
I
met her on an earlier occasion in her office in London.
I see. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. What would you like to know?
Well, why were you meeting her?
Well, in 1979, I became an adjunct professor at the City University in London. That was a part-time thing. I'd go there every May for 6 weeks and do whatever was helpful. My friend, a man who ran the banking center, had started the banking center, was a man named Brian Griffiths. And Brian Griffiths had asked me to join his center to help him get the center started, to start a research program to see what else could be done. And we ran a lot of conferences. So I was involved in what was going on in Britain at the time. And one day, I got a call after I was home. I got a call from my friend Carl Bruner, who said, Mrs. Thatcher, he was going to meet Mrs. Thatcher the next day in Switzerland. The reason for that, this is a long story, so...
That's all right, we've got plenty of time.
The reason for that was he was working with the Central Bank of Switzerland, and Mrs. Thatcher had just come into office, and she was interested in how she could get her monetary policy organized to bring down inflation in England, which at that time was running somewhere between 15 and 20%. And so she had talked to the head of the Swiss National Bank, a man named Lloyd Wheeler. And Fritz Leutwiler had said, well, she asked him a lot of questions, as was her wont. I mean, she was very, she liked detail, and she wanted to know how everything worked. And she asked him so many questions that he said, well, I don't know the answer to those questions. If you want to know the answer to those questions, you should talk to, I ask Carl Bruner when I need those things. And she said, well, where can I meet this man, Bruner? And he said, well, he's here in Switzerland, and I'll arrange it for you. So she called him. And anyway, the next day, a car came and picked up Bruner, and he had asked me, in the meantime, what should we do, what should I say to Margaret Thatcher? Well, he had a meeting with her, and out of that meeting, we both went to London to meet with her to talk more about monetary policy, so that's how I was invited. We spent the day, divided the day between the Bank of England, which runs the monetary policy for England. We talked to them, they were, of course, very negative, very opposed to most of what we had to say, and then we went over to meet the Prime Minister. And there were six of us at the time, because they invited, in addition to Bruner and me, they had invited some other people, all foreigners. That is, one German, one Italian, one Swiss, two of us. And we discussed with her what she should do to bring down the rate of inflation and what consequences it would have. So that's really where I met her.
I see. Did you meet again?
I met her again very briefly with when I went there with Brian Griffiths to talk about some other matters that about British economic policy.
May I ask? Naively, was your advice taken, and was it good?
Well, I'd say the answer was in part, and I think so. I mean, you know, there are so many intervening things that can happen that you can be right for the wrong reasons or wrong for the right reasons. And so let's just say that we gave her some advice. She took part of it, and it worked out rather well.
Great. Wonderful. Now, do you have anything else to add about your specific time in Washington, that time at the end of Reagan's administration?
Excuse me, may I interrupt for a moment?
Yes.
I'm very sorry about this. I'd like on tape to find what you think of Mrs. Thatcher.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Well, Mrs. Thatcher was, do you want to ask the question so you'll have it on the record?
Okay, Dr. Meltzer, tell us what you think of Mrs. Thatcher.
Well, my evaluation of her is, of course, more based upon what I saw her do than my own 2 hours or so of immediate presence. But you can't help but be impressed with her. I mean, she's a remarkable person. I've never met another politician who wanted to know as much about the detail of how things worked and what they did, and she was one incident will illustrate that. When we were explaining something to her, in the midst of my explanation, she turned to me and said something which indicated that I wasn't getting through to her. I mean, that she didn't understand what I was saying, that it was too involved. And so she said something which clearly indicated, you better explain it to me in a different way, because otherwise you're wasting my time and your own. And I mean, she was very direct and very forceful, and very much in command. Now, part of that is the British House of Commons tradition, where you have to defend yourself publicly, and so you have to at least have some idea of what you're talking about. But it was deeper with her. I mean, she really wanted to know what she was getting into and what she was not getting into. And so that was one very strong aspect of it. The other was the unusual ability that all good leaders have, I mean, political leaders have, the ability that she had to just a very great extent to focus completely on the subject that you were talking about, trying to master that for the hour that you were there. The next hour she might be talking about local politics or defense policy or foreign policy, and all that gets swept aside, and she now can focus, compartmentalize on another issue without losing the benefits of or what you had done the previous hour. She had that to a very extraordinary degree. I mean, the ability to absorb information from people and then to come back when at a future time and have questions that she could ask of other people based upon what she had learned from you, and questions that she asked of you based upon what she had learned from other people. So she absorbed information that way and really got to understand her own position.
And you did mention last time that she, and we know it also from the media, that she and Reagan had a very close, very,
very
good
close
relationship.
Yes,
yes,
right.
Yes. Now, the fact that you mentioned she asked questions of you to explain things, I will be Margaret Thatcher. You mentioned last time that part of your charge was to present the macroeconomic something.
Forecast.
Right. For the layperson, could you define macro and microeconomics?
Sure. Macroeconomics means global, just as macrobiotic does in food. It means global. It's the total. Micro is the detail. So if we want to talk about how do households or individuals behave, how do firms behave, why does this company produce this product in that way, in a particular way, that's all part of microeconomics. We want to talk about why is employment high or low, or why is unemployment high or low, or what is happening to inflation or the exchange rate, things which people are talking about very much at the moment. Those are macroeconomic. They have to do with the operation of the whole economy.
That right. Sounds good to me.
And every year, in fact, twice a year, the government comes out with a forecast of what's going to happen during the year, and also with some projections of what's going to happen over the next 5 years. and they need those numbers, those forecasts, to prepare their budget. When they write down that what expenditure is going to be or what taxes collections are going to be, they have to have some idea of how much income is going to be, what rate of inflation is going to be, and what the interest rate is going to be. So one of the jobs that gets done, not by the Council of Economic Advisors, but by the Council of Economic Advisors in cooperation with the Treasury and the Office of Management and Budget, is to come up with forecasts of what the economy is going to do.
Okay, thank you very much. That lends it to me. Are there any other things you want to tell us about your time, that particular time in Washington?
No. As I think I told you, I went there perhaps convinced that it's easy to think as you sit outside that if only you had the opportunity to be there that you could change things. I had enough experience around Washington to be sure that that wasn't true, that there wasn't much that any one individual could do. And so I went with not much expectation of being able to accomplish a great deal and was not disappointed.
Oh, but you did. You wrote a definitive report. Did you do any...